Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, the very talented singer-songwriter and author Richard Marx talks about his time with Paul Newman.
And he came out to get something from his car. We see him, we just stop talking and just staring at him like bumbling idiots, like with our jaws dropped. Because you're gonna, like, holy shit, it's Paul Newman. He goes to his car, opens his car door, reaches in, gets something, closes the door, and as he starts to walk back to the building, he looks over and sees us staring at him. So he stops and walks right to us. And as he's walking to us, we don't know where to look or what to do. And he comes right up, and as he approaches us, he holds out his hand and says, "Hey guys, you want some jelly beans?"
Today on the show, musician Richard Marx, author of the new book, Stories to Tell, talks about his time with Paul Newman. Stay close.
Hey, it's Richard Marx, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener, by the way, if you're a new listener, you have a lot of catching up to do. But either way, you guys, welcome to Storyworthy. I'm so glad you're here today. I hope you enjoyed the story last week by comedian Suzanne Westenhofer. Suzanne told this story that blew my mind because I'm a fan of hers, right? So she's a comedian, and she's just had this amazing career over the last 30 years. She's really a force in comedy, right? She was like the first lesbian comedian to ever be on David Letterman, and she's had like, oh my gosh, like four albums and a bunch of DVDs. Anyway, she comes on the show and she tells a story that she had a traumatic brain injury a couple of years ago, like 5 years ago, where she was out to dinner with her girlfriend and another couple. She goes out to get the valet. She falls to the ground and then she wakes up 3 weeks later. I shit you not. At Cedars-Sinai, right, Richard? And she's in a coma.
Holy shit.
Yeah, I know. And anyway, remarkable story, you guys. Go back, listen to Suzanne Westenhofer and her story about her traumatic brain injury. Holy cow. It's a really amazing story. And she is not only a survivor, but an incredible talent.
Who's going to top that story, though? That seems unfair. It's a little unfair. Who's going to top the traumatic brain injury story? Oh, yeah. Let me tell you about this time when I wrote this pop song.
I know. Sometimes the stories are really big like that. Like one time this girl told a story. Oh, my God. Sasha, I forget her last name. She writes on Glow. She was run over by a train.
Wow.
Yeah. So we get some cool stories, man. But this is going to be a great story. Today, you guys, stick with me because I'm here with singer-songwriter and author Richard Marx. And he's talking about the time he met Paul Newman. And I got to tell you, man, Paul Newman, Butch Cassidy.
Yep.
Get out of here.
I mean, Butch Cassidy, The Sting, Cool Hand Luke, The Hustler, you name it.
Yeah. So good. And for some reason, specifically Butch Cassidy, I think for me, it was about like my childhood and my father loved that movie. Everybody, we all love that movie. And the Raindrops Keep Falling on Your Head song.
Burt Bacharach song.
Oh, so beautiful, right?
Yep.
So I am excited to hear about your story about meeting Paul Newman, for goodness sake. But before we get to that, I definitely want to talk about your new book, Stories to Tell. It is a memoir. And, it's just so fun. I'm really happy for you.
Thank you.
These stories involve, it's really incredulous the amount of time you have been making music.
I know, and I'm only 30.
And that, no, but it's just such a body of work. And then the fact that you're an only child, I find that interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the fact that I'm an only child, I mean, it's certainly there are exceptions to this rule, but I found that it's probably one of the main things that made me not want to be in a band. I love having a band. I love working with other musicians. I love collaborating. But I never wanted to be the singer in a band. I wanted to be an artist, a solo artist. I never, I was asked to join bands throughout throughout my career. Early in my, like right before I got a record deal, I was even asked to audition to for Chicago when Peter Cetera left.
Oh my God.
And I knew their catalog and I knew the guys in Chicago. I knew Peter. I was young. I was only 21, 22. And I didn't even audition because as much as I thought, you know, that was a really wonderful opportunity to at least audition, I knew I didn't want the job. I didn't want to be in a band. I'm an only child. I don't play well with others.
That is unbelievable.
That's actually not true. I make a joke about that. I do play well with others. I love collaborating.
No, I know you do. You collaborate constantly and with all of the biggest people in the world. Barbara Streisand, are you kidding me? Lionel Richie and Luther Vandross and all of these people. But wait a second. Oh my gosh. This is only blowing my mind so much because I've seen the Chicago documentary 3 times.
Yeah.
Have you watched it?
Yeah, I mean, I saw it once.
It's so good.
Yeah, it's really good.
And the whole story with Terry Kath and what happened to him and then the whole Peter Cetera fiasco. And in the documentary, they kind of don't show him in a great light. So it's no wonder he didn't participate in that documentary.
Right. Also, you know, I know Peter a little bit. I know Robert Lamb very well. I've known him for a long time and I really love Robert Lamb. And he wrote, I mean, Peter wrote some of the classic Chicago songs, but so did Robert, especially in the early days, you know, 25 or 6 to 4 and Saturday in the Park. And does anybody really know what time it is? And Robert's a really wonderful writer and a really great friend and great guy. But I also am friendly with Peter. And I, you know, I think Peter Cetera might have the single most distinctive singing voice I've ever heard.
Yeah.
He's a great singer, technically.
Sure.
But I mean, like if you name someone that you think is a unique sounding singer, mm-hmm. Joe Cocker was unique. But there are guys who are sort of in that, like that sort of have, Rod Stewart could be put in that category, even Bryan Adams a little bit. Sometimes when I'm singing rock songs, my voice is really raspy.
Yeah.
But Peter Cetera, there's no one that sounds remotely like Peter Cetera.
Yeah.
Whether you like it or not, he's so unique.
And he really was a front man. I mean, he was such a front man. He really who knows? But yeah, an amazing musician as well. And you have collaborated, like you said, with so many people. And so, I want to go back to as a single child, because I have one daughter, only one, and she's 14 and she's very much into her YouTube channels and also performing by herself. She's a big fan of Bo Burnham right now. Burnham. Did you see that guy's special?
Yeah. Really funny.
Impressive, huh?
Yeah.
And I was just thinking about, you know, because I'm from a family of 6, you know, a big family. So being from just one, it's good to know that they can turn out so successful, like you, Richard Marx. And your father wrote jingles when you were little and you would kind of sing background and stuff. So you were around music.
Oh, yeah. I grew up in a musical household and not just a musical household, but, you know, both my parents were professionally in the music business, not in the record business.
Right.
But making music professionally every day, day in and day out. I grew up in a recording studio, you know.
I mean, that's
awesome.
That's exciting. Yeah.
It was so great. I mean, I still remember the smells of, you know, because a lot of times my dad would use members of the Chicago Symphony. There would be these huge orchestra dates for these, especially when he would do, in addition to jingles, sometimes he would do what they call sales films, like promotional films for like Oldsmobile. And there would be like 15 or 20 minutes of music that would be all orchestrated with a full symphony. And I just remember the smells of the instruments and the cases and just the buzz when all these musicians would be in the room. And then I would be sitting there as a little boy and then hearing that music come through the speakers and knowing that my father created it. There was no question that I was hooked from the time I was old enough to even understand what was happening.
I mean, it's like an education that you can't get unless you're right there. Because I'm sure you were able to discern the instruments one from another.
Eventually, yeah. I mean, at first it just, you know, I'm a little kid. I didn't really get it. I just thought it was thrilling.
I try to, when we listen to music in the car, I try to tell my daughter, like, do you hear the bass? Or do you hear
that's
the,
good.
You know, I try to get her to isolate things so she hears. Okay, so looking at the book, and there's a couple of things I wanted to talk to you about before we get to your story about Paul Newman. But real quickly, here in the book, in the very front, you talk about when you go to see you live in concert, when you hear the songs playing before you come out, you choose them. But who doesn't, like, how... Are there musicians that don't choose their pre-music?
Oh, yeah. I think most of them don't.
Oh, God.
They either just let somebody else create a playlist, or they just – sometimes the music is, a satellite radio or, you know, there's – I don't know that there are a lot of artists that take the time to do that or really care about that, but I really care about it.
I care about that so much. Oh my gosh, you're setting the tone. You're setting the whole goddamn thing.
Yeah.
Seriously, I never occurred to me that they didn't select their own playlist. Over the years, I've heard a lot of Beatles before shows, and maybe that's just because they figure, oh, everybody likes the Beatles or something.
Yeah. I mean,
I don't know.
You can't go wrong, but I get excited about every tour for a lot of reasons, but one of the really nerdy things that I do before every tour is make a new playlist for the walk-in music.
Dude, I have a playlist for every season, you know, summer 2021, fall, and that's what I'm listening to then. I am so attuned to making sure that the vibe in the room starts at the very bottom, and that's the music, and then the lighting, and then the heat and cool.
Sure. You know, it's a whole experience.
Yeah.
But you know, how many times have you been somewhere in a setting like that and you've heard a song and you go, what is this song? I don't know this song, but I love this song. And now you can Shazam it so you can know what it is if it's loud enough.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And so what I try to do with each tour is I create a playlist of mostly my friends, people who I am friendly with, who have, whether it's new music or whatever, but songs that I really love that you probably have never heard on the radio. And so I see people, sometimes I peek out and look at the audience and I see people like looking up and listening and bopping their heads or whatever. And I think, okay, well, maybe they're going to go download that song or give my friend, you know, an eighth of a cent.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what it's all about, you know, supporting each other. And I'm sure they do the same for you in other settings.
Probably not, but I don't care. I do it for
them. Well, yeah. I bet they're reading your book. I'll bet you that. All right. Here's something I picked up in your book. You used to live right up the street from where I live right now. I live in Los Feliz.
Yeah.
And you lived on Vermont Avenue, and you talk about having, you know, the traffic up to the Greek Theater. You have to turn your car around and go up, and it could take some time. Like, you couldn't even get home sometimes if you were out because there's a concert up the street, and you can't get your house.
Oh, my God. So the 2 years before the year before I got my record deal, I bought that house. It was my first house. And for a year and a half, every time there would be a concert at the Greek, I would pitch a fit. And I'd be like, God damn it. Now I can't. I would call. I write about this in the book. There were times when I would have a dinner date and I would just look outside and I'd call and go, fuck it. I can't make it. It's going to be an hour for me to even just turn around on my fucking street. And I got so pissed off and I would bitch about it. Well, 2 years later, I'm headlining the Greek Theater.
Oh, my God.
And I was just... I just thought it was so hilarious. And I told that story on stage that night. And I said, so if any of you are locals, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I apologize.
Yeah.
I feel your pain.
Richard, was that one of the more remarkable nights of your life? Truly. Like, you left your house. Did you walk up the street?
I couldn't walk up. It was too far up. But I left, you know, like 2 minutes before the gig.
That must have been.
And I had a police escort to get up there. And,
wow.
Yeah, that was up there. That was maybe second only to the first time I played a place outside of Chicago called Poplar Creek, which is long gone. But it was a similar kind of semi-outdoor venue like the Greek Theater, but in a suburb of Chicago. And it's where I grew up going to concerts.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was playing on that stage. I played it a couple times, but the first time I played there...
It's unbelievable.
I just kept looking around...
Yeah.
And by that point, I had, you know, I'd seen the view from the stage, but that view, I'd never been on that stage. And looking out, and I would think about all the time, I would look around the audience, the empty, you know, at soundcheck, I was looking out there and thinking, I sat there once. I sat there once. I sat over there. I sat up on the lawn once.
Forget it.
You know, it's pretty pretty exciting.
By the way, that house on Vermont, if you still owned it, I don't even know what house it is, but I guarantee you it's north of $3 million.
Oh, I know.
I mean, forget it. I mean,
I'll tell you what I paid for it.
Oh, I don't know if I want to hear. I'm gonna guess. $350.
$295. Now, mind you, I paid $295 and sold it 2 years later, 2.5 years later, for $450.
Oh, my God.
So I thought I was kicking ass at the time. And this was in 1986. Yeah, 86 or 87. Now, yeah, you're right. When I go up, or if I look at listings on Vermont, it's well into the millions. Yeah.
Yeah, I've lived in the neighborhood for 24 years, and it's wild. Do you remember Neil Diamond live at the Greek?
Yeah, of course. I think it was called Love at the Greek.
I forget. But
they called it Love at the Greek instead of Live at the Greek. Yeah, what he would play. I saw him when I was a kid. My mother was a big Neil Diamond fan, is still, but she was really, really into him when I was in high school or like junior high school. And let's face it, you know, in junior high school, I was not listening to Neil Diamond. You know, I respected his songwriting and I knew his older hits, but I wasn't keeping up with Neil Diamond. I was listening to Queen, you know, I was not into that. But my dad was, I forget why my dad couldn't go, but I took my mom, I went with my mom to see Neil Diamond, and I walked out of there a forever fan. It was one of the greatest concerts I've ever been to. But there is something, he had a thing at the Greek Theater, what, you know, he would play 11 nights in a row there and shit. Like he owned the Greek Theater, but there were, if you look at, there's even a, I think it's probably still on YouTube or on video. There was, and I've gotten to experience this kind of thing with audiences where sometimes it's transformative. Sometimes you have a great gig and everybody's having a great time and it's all fun. But then there are times when you have a relationship with a particular audience that, as corny as it sounds, is full on a 2-hour love affair. Where you are in love with everyone in that room and you can feel the love coming back to you. And it's beyond singing songs to people or talking to them. It's where we are one, where we are in love with each other. But you can see that at those shows with Neil at the Greek. And I know from having experienced that there's, again, it's nothing like it.
That is so special.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, I saw Paul McCartney at Dodger Stadium. And I swear to God, it was like that. And with every seat taken and nobody moved, nobody got up to go to the bathroom, nobody went and got a beer.
Right.
It was just perfection. And it was like 55,000 people. It was wonderful.
But I mean, like Neil Diamond in his way, when you're dealing with performers like Neil or McCartney, you know, there are a handful, Billy Joel, Elton, who have had 50-year careers or more, you're talking about an audience full of people who grew up with them, who have assigned certain songs that they created to pivotal moments in their lives. It's transformative. It's different than just going to a concert. It's life-changing.
Well, that has to happen to you a lot, that people come up to you and say, you know, we played your song at our wedding or we had sex to your song, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Does that happen?
All the time. And now,
all the time, yeah.
Now when somebody stops me and says, oh my God, we used your song at our wedding, I always go, should have known better.
Speaking of which, you are married to the lovely and incredibly talented Daisy Fuentes.
Yes.
And what a successful marriage. You guys are so in love. It's very beautiful to watch.
We really are, yeah.
But you also had a very successful first marriage because you have three boys. You've got three and they're all grown?
Yeah, I have the Marx Brothers. Yes, I have.
I can't believe I didn't think of that. That's so funny.
Yep. They're Brandon is 30, Lucas is 28, and my baby boy Jesse's 27.
Okay, who plays guitar?
All of them.
Yes. Isn't they that
all play,
great?
They all play piano. They all play guitar. They all write songs. They all sing their asses off.
Oh.
They all are putting music out and have been putting music out here and there. My middle son, Lucas, is the most further along in his career, mainly because as great a singer as he is, a few years ago, he really sort of decided he didn't want to pursue being an artist. He wanted to be a writer and producer and just wow. work and work and work. And now he just co-wrote the latest Katy Perry single called Electric.
Oh my gosh, really?
He's producing people. And he and I have been doing some work together for the last couple of years. He wrote and produced with me the single from my last album a year and a half ago. And then we just did a new song this week that will come out in September, it looks like. And so working with them is, you know, I've worked with all of them, but yeah, it's a trip, you know.
Oh my gosh!
To be honest with you,
I don't.
I'm very proud of them. There has always been a part of me in the last few years that kind of wouldn't have been bummed out if they had gone into another profession, only because the music business is so fucking hard, and it's never been harder to make a living at it. Unless you have a catalog of songs, you know, mm-hmm. you have a mm-hmm. fan base, mm-hmm. but this is their passion. And I'm so proud. I'm really, all nepotism aside, I'm so impressed and proud of what they do.
Well, you're repeating what your father did for you.
Yeah, I think so. I think especially, you know, my kids grew up not only being in the studio with me, but going on the road with me and like standing in the wings and watching thousands of people adore their dad.
That's of course what I was thinking. I was picturing, what is it like for those kids to be backstage and look out? I mean, my daughter
they love it.
Would be floored.
No, they love it. And now I've just had that experience with my granddaughter. I have a 12-year-old granddaughter.
Oh, how sweet.
And the summer before COVID, I played near where she lives and she came and hung out with me. And when I was on stage, Daisy took her to the side of the stage and let her peer around the wall to see the audience. And everybody was up and dancing and holding up signs and laughing and smiling. And I was rocking out with the band. And I looked at her name is Maddie. And Maddie just had the biggest grin on her face. And she's now, you know, she's a dancer and she's making up songs. And I think she's going to be in show business too.
That's so exciting. It must be nice to have some female blood around the boys.
Finally.
Okay, another real quick comment is your mention of the Peter Gabriel album, So.
Yeah.
That album was also, I'm not a musician, but I mean, I play some instruments, but that album was pivotal. Am I right?
Yeah. Well, especially to most of the musicians I know who, whenever that comes up, I have yet to meet a musician I respect it anyway, who hasn't said, yeah, it's one of the greatest albums of all time, or it meant the world to me, or, you know, it affected me and so many other musicians as well as the public.
For sure. Because it wasn't just like Sledgehammer. Yeah. And it wasn't just In Your Eyes. It was like, Don't Give Up.
And Mercy Street.
And Mercy Street. Right.
Yeah. And Big Time.
Oh, Big Time. Forget it. I was lucky to see him during that. I saw that show in Pittsburgh where I'm from, and I still remember it. And Red Rain coming down and all the red lights came down. And oh, my God.
Well, Red Rain opens the album. And I remember I stood outside this record store on Melrose Avenue. There was this really cool record store. I forget what it was called, on a corner on Melrose Avenue. And I stood outside at 9:30, but they opened at 10 because I was, you know, back then they might get a dozen copies of an album. So you wanted to get in there and get it. And I got the CD and I ran home and I had a decent sound system and I put my headphones on. And I was a huge Peter Gabriel fan anyway. And he would take years in between making records.
Oh, yeah.
So you had to wait a long time. And I think I write about this in the book actually. And I sat on my floor and Red Rain came on, and by the end of it, I was crying. And that's not typical of me.
Yeah.
But I just had tears streaming down my face. I was, to this day, that song is just wrecks me emotionally. But it was also the quality of the playing and the passion in his voice and the writing. And I'd never heard anything like it. I was just so moved by it.
In Red Rain, he almost gets a Leonard Cohen quality to his voice.
Yeah, totally.
He just is like getting grovelly. And all he's saying is the same thing over and over.
Red Rain coming down. Red Rain coming down. I mean, it's unbelievable.
It's like he's going through a transformation on me and the red, red sea.
Brilliant.
Over me. God. So I was liking to see that in your book. We're going to go over to your story in just a second because I am excited to hear more about Paul Newman. I love his salad dressing.
Yeah. He used to joke that his salad dressing outgrossed his films.
And then he also has I think there's tomato sauce and there's a lot.
Yeah, he's got popcorn and cookies. And all the money from his products have gone to charity, to various charities, but mostly it funds the Hole in the Wall Gang Camp.
How phenomenal is that? That is so.
Yeah, what a legacy.
Yeah, what a legacy. And I also, of course, Robert Redford, either of those, they would be my. What do you call it? Like your
hall pass?
I was going to say my meal ticket. No, my
your meal ticket
or my hall pass. Yeah.
Your hall pass slash meal ticket.
We'll see. Yeah. All right,
so
you guys.
If it came down to Newman or Redford, and you could only be with one, who would you pick?
Well, Redford, because he's alive.
That's a good point. Okay, but both of them in their prime, like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid era. You got to be with Paul or you're going to be with
I'd have Redford. My first threesome. I would.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I couldn't choose.
You'd be quite a lucky girl.
There's so much blue eyes, so many blue eyes. It's just, wow.
Yeah.
Those guys. And also, by the way, Butch Cassidy, it moved very slowly. It was a slow moving, well, especially now when we look back on how they used to really sit on long shots and stuff. And so it just made everything even more tasty.
I think... for years, I'm going to still go with it. I've been asked so many times. I think that's my favorite movie of all time.
Yeah. It's so good.
I've seen it. I must have seen Butch Cassidy 15 times maybe. And I need to see it. It's been years. I'm going to watch it again.
And then at the end, and all the federales are surrounding the little hut.
And you know what's going to happen, and still you're all freaked out.
Ay-yi-yi. And you just think, maybe. Oh, my God. I think also that was why it was such a successful movie, because that doesn't happen very often when the good guys get killed.
Right.
You know?
Well, they weren't good guys.
But I know. They stole a lot of money. But the point is...
And they killed people.
All right. Listen, we're going to get over your story in just a second. But I did want to tell everybody that Story Smash, the storytelling game show, is going to be back at the Hollywood Improv this fall. And check out StorySmashShow.com for when that's going to happen. You know, Richard, we played my game show Story Smash at the Improv for 3 years, sold out every month for 3 years, and then the pandemic.
Shit.
I know. So when we come back, I've got to get you on as a judge.
Okay.
The other judges are always Blanka Patch and Danny Zucker and Marilyn Rice Cub and all these fabulous comedians. It is pee your pants funny. StorySmashShow.com, you guys. Don't forget to check it out. All right, you guys, he's here right now. You've heard him talking. Grammy winning singer and songwriter Richard Marx. He is truly one of the most accomplished. You really are one of the most accomplished, you know, singer songwriters in history of popular music, of course.
Oh, go on.
No, it's true. It's really interesting. I mean, your very first self-titled album, 1987, went triple platinum, making you the first male solo artist to have 4 singles from their debut, crack the top 3 on the Billboard Hot 100. That's crazy.
Yeah, that was good times.
You were on a roll.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I wonder if it was because you were, it was your first... like outing of what was in your heart or in your soul or your heart. Do you know what I mean? Like when you first started making records, maybe you had all this bottled up in you since you were a kid or something. Could any of that be true?
Maybe. But I also think, you know, I love this old expression that success is where opportunity and preparation collide.
Yeah.
And I worked my ass off. Even though I was young when my first record came out, I was a seasoned veteran already. In the studio as a songwriter. I'd written songs for other people. I had sung vocals on tons of hit records by other people. I had really paid my dues. And then that first single, Don't Mean Nothing, part of it was I had 3 of the Eagles on that record. and rock radio just hugged it and embraced it. And then I never really thought that Don't Mean Nothing would cross over to the pop charts, but it became a top three pop single as well. And then we were just sort of off to the races for about 10 years.
So exciting. Yeah. It is so exciting. By the way, that song Hazard, you know, it tells a story, the girl and the guy, and then it's in Nebraska, Hazard,
yeah.
Nebraska.
Yeah.
And was that a true story, or did you make that whole story up?
Well, I mean, it's completely fictional. I have people come up to me all the time, and say, is that song autobiographical? And I go, yep, I killed this chick in Nebraska many years ago.
Dude,
wrote a song about it.
A lot of times, Dan Fogelberg used to look at articles in the paper, and he would write based on the headline. Look at the Beatles, Day in the Life.
Yeah. No, this was – Hazard was a completely made-up fictional story. It was only called Hazard at the very – the whole song was written except for the title. And I said it in Nebraska because when I was singing the melody, the word Nebraska sang so well in that line in the chorus. And I had the whole story written. And then all I had was the opening line of the song is, my mother came to – when I was just 7, and I knew I needed a two-syllable name of a town. I knew it was in Nebraska. So I did what – I was very resourceful. This was in 1990.
No internet.
No internet, but I called the Nebraska Chamber of Commerce and spoke to a lovely woman there who agreed to fax me the names of every city and town in the state. So all of a sudden, my fax machine starts spitting out page after page after page. I couldn't believe how many fucking cities and towns were in Nebraska. And I put all the pages across this big desk, and I shuffled them together, and I closed my eyes, and I put my finger down, and it was, you know, like Spucket. Or, you know, it's like, I can't use that. But the second time I put my finger down, it wasn't on Hazard, but it was right below Hazard. And I saw the word Hazard and I went, fuck yes,
yeah,
that's
that it. That is it. That is it.
And I went to Hazard, Nebraska. It's the town of Hazard, Nebraska is basically just a building, a post office. You know, there's no town.
There's signs,
I think the whole –
there have to be signs.
There's signs. So I've got a picture in front of the Hazard sign, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Very funny. Very funny. Okay, a couple more things and we're going with the story. One more thing.
Yeah.
I've listened to you and Daisy on your wonderful podcast, Tequila Talk, which is really fun because you guys, you drink tequila and you chat. It's fun.
Yeah.
I also cannot roll my R's.
Thank you.
And Daisy makes it – of course, she's Cuban. Yes, we know it's easy
she's
for
Cuban.
Her. And I'm like
– well, I mean – in fairness, of course, every Latin person can roll their R's, but, you know, my mother rolls her R's like she's Cuban, and a bunch of my friends.
Yeah, my daughter
can. The thing is annoying. Yeah, okay, it's just the thing that, look, we're in the minority. Most people can roll their R's. And it's not like they were taught to roll their R's. They just, I can't
just
do
try.
It. I'm not going to even try. I can't do it.
Enrique.
So when somebody says, like when Daisy looks at me and she'll say my name, Ricardo, but with the really long Ricardo, right? And I go, fuck, I wish I could do that. And she'll go, do it. And she'll just go, and she'll just roll her R's at me as if that's going to fucking help me learn how to roll my R's. Everybody does that to me.
I know. I can't do that either.
But she does it. She does it beautifully.
Yeah, and let me tell you, I read in the book that you used to play racquetball, and I was wondering then how do you not play pickleball? I know that you said Daisy plays some pickleball, but that's like the funnest sport in the whole world, pickleball.
I just haven't. I'm not against
it. Oh, you're going to love it.
I just haven't yet. Yeah, everybody says I'm going to love it.
Yeah, it's like old man tennis, but it's fast and fun.
Well, I play tennis. I play tennis every week, but I want to get into pickleball.
Yeah, I play both as well. It's a little hard adjusting because pickleball, you know, the ball, of course, is flat. basically.
Right.
It's more like,
it's dead.
Yeah, it's more like wreck, yeah. Whatever. And so, and then also, you know, you hit it as hard as you think you're hitting it, and it doesn't go like a tennis
gotcha.
Racket. So it gets a little.
It doesn't sound fun to me the way you describe it, but I'm going to try it.
You know what I think I like about it is it's a community sport, right? Because you got
yeah.
the size of a tennis
Everybody
court
plays it.
With four sets of four playing on one tennis court. So there's 16 people able to play at the same time.
Yeah, social.
Yeah, and then
yeah.
everybody kind of like round robins because the games only last like 12 or 15 minutes.
Right.
Anyway, all right.
Right.
Listen, you guys, find Richard over on Twitter where you are amazing and truthful and to the point. And I just texted Pierce Morgan this morning yelling at him for you.
Thank you.
I know he blocked you.
He did. He's a chicken shit. He's an asshole and
I
a chicken shit and a misogynist and a racist and a prick.
All of
you
those
can quote
things.
Me on
it's
that.
True. No, it's true. And so I'm doing my part. I'm retweeting when you want to tell him something. I'll be
cool.
your go through.
I appreciate that.
And then he'll block me too. But for now, it's all right.
Yeah.
All right, you guys. Yeah, find Richard over there at Richard Marks. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for the very talented Richard Marks.
Okay. It's actually two stories in one. It was 1990, and I had just not only ended a 15-month-long world tour, but a month prior to this story, my first son, Brandon, was born. So I'm home. I was living in L.A., and I had not been home for any length of time in a long, long time. So I was kind of catching up with friends and just sort of reacclimating to life off the road. I was getting ready to start a new album, my third album. And I was pals with a wonderful recording engineer to this day named David Cole. David and I had worked together on my first couple albums, and we were pals. And I hadn't seen him much at all because I'd been touring nonstop for a few years. So he was working on a project at a studio that's no longer there called Lion Share Recording, which was owned by Kenny Rogers. And that's where so many huge records were made. Rod Stewart, Barbara Streisand, David Lee Roth. I mean, everybody worked there. And I recorded there as well. So my friend David was there doing something and said, hey, you know, I'm going to have a break for an hour or so tomorrow. Do you want to come by and catch up? So I said, yeah, I'll bring some food and we'll just kind of hang out. So we're catching up. I spent some time with him. He walked me out into the parking lot of the studio to say goodbye. And we're standing by my car talking, about to say goodbye, when we notice a lone figure exit the building and walk to a car. And you know, this guy was like maybe 50 feet away from us. But we both turned because, you know, just we noticed somebody coming into the parking lot. And then we realized it was Paul Newman. Now, I don't care who you are. You're going to fucking stare at Paul Newman.
He was in the recording studio?
He was in the building. There were some offices downstairs below the studios. So he was having a meeting in there, apparently, and he came out to get something from his car. We see him. We just stop talking and just staring at him like bumbling idiots, like with our jaws dropped. Because you're gonna, like, holy shit, it's Paul Newman.
Yeah.
He goes to his car, opens his car door, reaches in, gets something, closes the door, and as he starts to walk back to the building, he looks over and sees us staring at him. So he stops and walks right to us. And as he's walking to us, we don't know where to look or what to do. And he comes right up. And as he approaches us, he holds out his hand and says, hey, guys, you want some jelly beans? He had gone out to get a handful of jelly beans from his car because he loves jelly beans. And I just go, hell yeah, absolutely, I would like some jelly beans. He hands me some jelly beans, hands them to David, and then says, I swear to God, he goes, hey, I'm Paul. How are you guys doing? What's your name? I go, my name's Richard. This is my friend David. He goes, oh, what are you guys doing? Are you guys working in the studio? He's just chatting with us.
Oh,
and he's so sweet and cool and like, and the most handsome person you've ever seen in your life, you know? And so we're talking, just shooting the shit for a minute. And I see this other guy come out of the building. I think he came out to see where Paul was. the guy comes over seeing us talking, and as he comes up behind Paul, he sees me and says, "Paul, holy shit, this is the guy I was just telling you about a half an hour ago. Now I'm confused." And Paul looks at me and looks at his friend and says, "This guy, Richard?" And I said, "Wait, what's going on?" This guy introduces himself. I forget what his name was. He said, "Man, this is so weird. We're having a meeting planning this charity event in 3 weeks for Paul's charity, and we need a headline performer." And I said to Paul, "You know, there's this young guy who's like having all these hits, and I think he's really charity-minded because I read that he's really involved with charities. Maybe we could get this guy, Richard Marks." And here you are, 30 minutes later in the parking lot.
Oh, my God.
So Paul goes, "Holy shit, man." He goes, "It's true. We were just talking about you." And he said, and I said, "Well, what's the charity thing?" And he said, "Well, it's in 3 weeks." And I said, "You don't have to say anymore. I'm in." And he went, "Well, wait a minute. Don't you want?" I said, "No, if it's your charity, I'm in town in 3 weeks. Just tell me where to be. I'm happy to do that." And he went, "Oh man, that's so nice of you." So, you know, we exchanged, you know, I gave the guy my number and said goodbye, and I get home, and my ex-wife, Cynthia, she, like you, had always said that that was her hall pass. Like, she was obsessed with Paul Newman. So I couldn't wait to get home to tell her that I had just met Paul Newman.
Yeah.
I'm in the midst of telling her with her jaw dropped that I just met Paul Newman, and our phone rings. As I'm telling her about this, I go, "Hello? Hey, Richard, it's Paul Newman." And I go, and I go like this. I go, "Hey, Paul." And my ex is going, it's like now her head starts spinning around. She can't believe I'm now on the phone with him. And he says, "Man, I just wanted to tell you, first of all, it was great to meet you. And I can't thank you enough for agreeing to do this charity thing with us." But he said, "I just told my daughter that I met you and that I didn't know. Look, I listen to classical music. I don't listen to pop music. And I feel so, she called me an asshole, a stupid asshole for not knowing who you were." I said, "Paul, are you kidding me? Like, whatever. It's totally cool." So now I have to have a couple of production meetings for this upcoming charity event. They want me to be part of how the performance is going to go and everything. And at every production meeting, Paul Newman is there because that's who he was. So I spent time with him just chatting and just he was such a cool – he was everything you wanted Paul Newman to be, right?
What kind of car did he drive? Because I know he's a race car driver. So what was he driving around? Do you remember?
I seem to remember that it was not impressive. It was like a like a white Volvo or something. Like it wasn't anything.
Something conservative.
At least that day in the parking lot, you know?
Yeah, funny.
So I go and do the charity event a few weeks later. I remember when it was at the Beverly Hilton Hotel. And it was a big black tie affair. And
sure.
I mean, everybody, especially from that era, was there. Sidney Poitier was there, and this one and that one, and Jack Lemmon was there. And, you know, like famous person after famous person, and it was packed. But of course, Paul was the man of the hour, right? My ex and I had gotten there maybe 5 minutes before Paul and Joanne, his wife. So we're in this big crowd of people, and as he walks in, you know, people are surrounding him and Joanne, and as they're trying to make their way through to their table, and he spots me and excuses himself from people and goes over to me because he wants to introduce himself to my ex-wife. Because I don't think I even told him that she was like in love with him, but he came over and said, "Hey, you know, Richard's told me so much about you. Wow. I just wanted to say hello, and how's the baby?" And like, and of course, she melted. You know, he was just such a charming gentleman.
He remember you had shown him pictures or something?
Yeah, I'd shown him pictures for sure. So, okay. So it was a really amazing thing. And he sent me a beautiful letter, which I have framed in my office to this day. So now, 7 years later, I don't have any communication with him. I don't see him or talk to him. 7 years later, my son, who I had mentioned, is now 7 years old. And we're living in Chicago, and we get invited to a Formula One race in Milwaukee, which is about 90 minutes away from where we live. And it was the Newman Haas racing team was part of this race. And I had become friendly with one of the men who worked for the Newman Haas racing team. So he invited me And I said, can I bring my son? He said, yeah. And I said, do you think Paul's going to be there? And he said, I doubt it. He said, he doesn't come to these races much. But I said, that's fine. Well, you know, it'd be fun to take my kid to a race. And so they let us park in the back by the pit. And it was a really cool event.
Newman, to see behind the scenes would be fascinating.
Yeah, and we met the drivers, and my son Brandon got to look, you know, really see the cars up close.
And the pit crew.
And the pit crew, how it's all put together.
Neat, yeah.
They didn't have a good outing that day. The team came in last. But it was really fun. So I'm at my car, about to get in my car, and I'm saying goodbye to these people from the Newman Haas racing team. When we see this guy on a moped weaving in and out of cars coming to where we are, and it's Paul. He was there. I had no idea he was there. In fact, I think some of the people who worked there were surprised to see him. But he had flown to Milwaukee for this race, and he was fucking pissed that his team lost. So he was cranky. And he came up, but I was like, oh my God, it's Paul Newman on a moped. And he pulls up to where we are, and he's kind of venting to this guy that we're talking, one of the guys we're talking. He's like, fuck, you know, like, and he's being very specific about this driver didn't do this right, and the car, we need to do this. And he was very vested in it, you know, very, he cared about it. And this guy said, hey, Paul, this is Richard Marks. And Paul looked at me like, wait a minute. And I said, yeah, we did this. He goes, Richard, yeah, how are you, man? And he remembered me from the thing. And I said, oh, it's so good to see you again, man. I'm sorry about your team. And he's like, yeah. He said, sometimes it's good days, bad days. And I said, by the way, this is my son, Brandon. He goes, oh, he was just a baby when I met you, right? I said, yep. So all my sons were very polite. And he shook his hand and looked him in the eye and said, hello, sir. Nice to meet you. And so we chatted for a minute. And I said, it was great to see you. And we wished each other well. And Brandon and I got in my car. And we start backing up to leave. And as soon as we got in the car, I said, Brandon, the guy you just met, that man you just met is a legend. He's not only one of the most accomplished and famous actors of all time, but he's raised hundreds of millions of dollars for charity. He's an icon. And I used words that a 7-year-old would understand, you know, just a superstar, one of the most famous people on the face of the earth. And my son turned around and looked out the back window and went, the old guy on the scooter?
No, you didn't.
Okay. Now, here's the...
Yes. Wait, why had he come over toward you guys anyway in the lot?
Because we were with members of the team that he was going to go and talk to.
Oh, he was trying to talk to those guys.
I just happened to be there at that moment when he pulled
up.
Sure,
sure.
All right. Now, 2 years later, I get a call from Paul Newman's secretary. Would I consider flying to Connecticut to perform at his hole-in-the-wall gang camp in the theater that they had built there? And she said, this invitation is directly from Paul, but he wanted me to tell you that he's not calling you himself only because he fears rejection.
I'm so sure. Oh, yeah, right.
Of course, I said, I'll do whatever I have to do. I'll be there for sure. So it was a couple months later. So I went to Connecticut, went to the camp, and was part of this really cool, they did an annual gala every year to raise money for the Hole in the Wall Gang Camp. I've actually done a bunch of stuff for them over the years.
And is this for underprivileged children, or who is this for?
It's for kids with cancer.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Yeah. So Paul decided many years ago to create a camp. It started in Ashford, Connecticut, which is where this one was. But now there are camps all over the world, hole-in-the-wall gang camps. He wanted to create a place where kids with cancer could go and just be kids. And if there was a kid that was bald from chemo, there were 10 of them. They didn't. Mm-hmm. Nobody looked weird. Nobody felt uncomfortable. Like, they were all going through the same shit. And they could
Amazing.
Have camaraderie, and they could support each other, and they could just play and be and do summer camp. You know, mm-hmm. like a normal mm-hmm. kid, except that they were ill. Mm-hmm. Amazing, really amazing. So this particular night, what they had, it's, I think it was the 7th year in a row, the 7th annual gala. And what they would do is they would have different performers. And then they would close every gala with a scene from a famous Broadway musical. And Paul would always be in that scene, but always in drag. Always
Wait,
in a
mean,
dress.
Really?
Yes.
So as the character, like if they were in South Pacific, he would be the female lead or
yes.
something? Or
yes.
Ah.
And he would sing, and but he would put on full, he would put on a wig, full makeup.
How funny.
A dress. He would always appear, but always in drag.
So people must have lost it. Yeah.
Oh, God, funny. It was hilarious. It was great.
Yeah.
So there I am in my dressing room. They had a little dressing room for me backstage. And I was tuning up my guitar because I was about to go on next. And the finale was after my performance. So there's a knock on the dressing room door, and it's Paul by himself. And he says, "Hey, Richard, I'm so sorry to disturb you, but I need to change for this last bit. Can I change in here? Because all the clothes are in here." I said, "Of course." So he closes the door. He's in there. He's rummaging through a box, going through like skirts and dresses and shit. And I'm tuning the guitar, and I'm looking in the mirror of the dressing room, and I'm watching him behind me. And finally, 10 minutes later, he's now wearing a dress that's open in the front, you know, so he's bare-chested. It's open down to his waist. He's wearing high heels. He's wearing makeup. He's got a wig on that's crooked, and he's wearing like necklaces, pearl necklaces. And he just turns to me and just stood there like, "What do you think?" And I'm sitting in this chair with my guitar, and I looked up at him and I went, "So you were Butch Cassidy, huh?"
Oh, like, my God.
And we had a laugh. And so I did my thing. And by the – I did like three songs, just me and my guitar, just solo yeah. acoustic. And so right before my last song, I don't know what possessed me, but I told the audience the story of the race and what my son said. And I hit that punchline. The old guy in the scooter, and the audience just erupted in laughter. And I looked over in the wings, and there was Paul standing there watching me, and he was laughing so hard. And so I did my last song, got a really nice ovation, and I walked off stage, and Paul was in the wings, and he hugged me and pulled me in close. I'll never forget this. And as he hugged me, he whispered, "Line of the night, kid."
Oh, God.
So that was my experience with Paul Newman. I saw him one or two times after that, but I never knew Paul. We weren't friends or anything like that, but I had four or five experiences. And what I love to tell people is Paul Newman was exactly who you wanted Paul Newman to be.
I love that. I love when they're who you want them to be.
Yeah.
That's the best.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the best. Yeah, no kidding. Wow. What an extraordinary experience for you. And I have to say, I think you were friends because even though if you didn't spend that much, time personally together, the fact that he kept calling you
yeah.
over the years,
yeah.
that's a friend because he knew he could trust you. He knew you'd pay off. He knew you'd show up. You're professional. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think he took a liking to me. In our brief times of hanging out together, I think one of the things he felt comfortable because he didn't want to be treated like a superstar. And he just he didn't want to talk about movies. He wanted to talk about cars and life. And so I didn't ever sort of germ him, that expression where I would just sort of like, I just treated him like a guy. And I think he felt comfortable around me, which was really nice.
Well, and also you're both accomplished and, I think it's a beautiful story. And I have to say, in your new book, Stories to Tell, like you said, published by Simon & Schuster, which is huge.
Yeah.
You talk about so many professionals, so many incredible people, like we said, Barbara Streisand and on and on and on and on. And what, at the end of the day, we learn as the public, we learn that everybody takes their pants off one leg at a time. Do you know what I mean? Celebrities are just celebrities. They're people.
Yes. There's that great Saturday Night Live skit with Christopher Walken, the More Cowbell.
Yeah.
Where he plays the famous producer, Bruce Dickinson. And he says to the band, "Listen, guys, I put my pants on one leg at a time like everyone else, except that once my pants are on, I make platinum records."
That's damn funny. All right, one more thing and we're out of here because I know you've got a lot to do. One more thing. In the book, you do talk about how you have always been able to will people toward you. You have had this openness in your life that there's something going on where you manifest it. And what is that?
I'm glad I'm not surprised in the little time we spent together, I'm not surprised that you would pick that out of the book. To me, the two main threads of my book are, I hope, gratitude and this ability to manifest is one word for it. I only started to realize it about 8 or 9 years ago. And it all started when I was 5 years old. My hero at the time was Davy Jones of the Monkees.
Oh, yeah.
And I met Davy Jones of the Monkees, and Davy Jones was really kind to me and really like left a really wonderful memory for me. I saw him 20 years later, and we had a really wonderful exchange then too. Starting when I was 5 years old with Davy Jones, I just always had this ability to will people who had made a significant impact on me. I'm not talking about like being a casual fan of someone, but people who really made an impact on me, with no exception other than Elvis Presley, who died when I was 12. Every single person in that category, I've either met, worked with, or become friends with, or all of the above. And in some cases, like even down to Daisy, my wife, I mean, I watched MTV all the time like everybody else. I was on MTV all the time. And when I would see
she probably introduced your videos.
She did. There's video of it on YouTube. So we have video of her introducing my videos back in the day.
Funny.
We were certainly aware of each other. And I knew a bunch of the VJs on MTV. I was friends with a couple of them.
Yeah.
Daisy was the only one I never met back then, but she was the one who I always had this fascination with, not just because she was so beautiful, but there was always something about her. I remember thinking, I bet she's cool. I bet I would really love hanging out with her. Now, I was married at the time.
She's smart, super smart. Street smartness.
And sarcastic and, sardonic as the day is long. It wasn't like, oh, I want to get with her. It wasn't that. I was married, happily married at the time. And it's interesting that of all the people back then, I was fascinated by her. And then when I became single for the first time really in my adult life, I met her immediately.
Really?
Yeah. So
wow,
it's everything. Well, it's everybody from
what was that run in? How did that happen?
It really sort of started on Twitter. We ended up following each other on Twitter because of we had a mutual friend on Twitter, and Daisy noticed this exchange between us.
Sure.
And so she weighed in on it, and I was like, oh wow, Daisy Fuentes. So we met because of Twitter.
Wow,
but
that's cool.
Yeah,
man.
I can't think of an exception. Peter Gabriel. You know, I only met Peter Gabriel once, but I met him, a year or right in the beginning of when I was making my first album. So I hadn't had any success as an artist, but I met him very briefly. And again, he was everything I wanted him to be in that moment. Mm. He gave me the opportunity to just thank him for the music that he made. And he was so gracious and kind to me. But right up to, when I was in high school, my favorite singer in the world was Kenny Loggins. I studied every nuance of every note Kenny Loggins ever sang. And Kenny Loggins and I are really close friends and have sung together and written together. And I've produced him. And this is just one of countless examples of these people who have made a real impact on me, who have become part of my life. I've just had this ability to will people into my path somehow, and I'm grateful for it.
That's really, really great. And you know what? You've impacted so many people's lives. So, it really does go both ways.
That's very sweet. Thank you.
Hey, thank you again so much for coming on. Really, you guys, check out Stories to Tell, Richard Mark's brand new book out. It is really good, entertaining as hell, and I really appreciate
your
time.
Thank you, Christine. It was really fun. And let's hang. I want to do the in-person book stuff with you.
Yeah, I'm going to definitely figure that out for
Great.
You. I'll help you with that.
All right,
you guys, one more time, on behalf of the very talented Richard Marks, my name is Christine Blackburn, saying make it a story-worthy week.
Follow me. I'll take you down to the river. Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.